Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbc.com/programs/techtent. Hello and a warm welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly status update on the technology business with me, Rory Catlin-Jones. And joining me in the tent this week from the BBC Tech Desk are Joe Miller.
Hello, Rory.
And Mark Ward.
Hello.
And this edition is primarily devoted to the way the tech industry thinks it can make a big difference in healthcare. So our special guest is a medical doctor and healthcare consultant at KPMG, Dr. Hilary Thomas.
Hello.
Welcome, Hilary. I noticed that you're wearing a fitness band. I'm wearing three of them. I think Joe's wearing one and Mark's wearing none. More on that later. Before we get healthy, let's start with a story breaking today in Russia. Now, imagine you're a blogger with a moderately big audience. Say 3,000 people read your work. How would you feel about having to register with a government oversight body as a media outlet? Well, that's what's happening from today in Russia, with a new law coming into force which imposes restrictions on bloggers and social networks. The law was painted by President Putin as a sensible piece of internet regulation, but it's been seen by many within and outside the country as a serious assault on freedom of expression. Famil Izmailov of the BBC's Russian service told me from Moscow this morning how prominent bloggers have reacted so far.
All bloggers warn that this is a political decision. It creates conditions and legal foundation to close down popular blogs. And as soon as they start doing that, that will create a storm. The bloggers themselves are quite defiant. They say, I'm not going to register, they're going to do whatever they want. Mind you, the newspapers today already published names of seven bloggers, some of them popular journalists, not critical of government at all, popular writers, authors like Boris Akunin, for example, who is quite critical of the regime, but at the same time, he's just a popular writer. He's an author, famous one as well. They say they're not going to get registered so far, but they will have to be asked to register with the Roskomnadzor, which is a government body looking after the communications regulator. At the same time, many people ask questions like, for example, why Roskomnadzor as a regulatory body wouldn't have to register itself, because it has a Twitter account with 11,000 followers, so it becomes a media outlet in itself. I've seen a really, really interesting hashtag in the Russian social media network, which is quite rude. I cannot possibly repeat it on air, but it's quite rude towards the regulatory body, Roskomnadzor.
It's a bit of a cat and mouse game, isn't it? Who's winning? Are the authorities managing to clamp down on the kind of content they don't want to see, or are the bloggers really managing to get it out there?
Well, the government says, Roskomnadzor itself says, that the law itself has got nothing to do with the bloggers. It's not against bloggers. People still can, have freedoms of speech. They have freedom to post whatever they want to. But this is directed towards extremism and misuse of social media. But at the same time, many people ask questions. What does it mean, talking about the misuse of social media? Does it mean that bloggers will have to check the information before they publish anything when they are licensed as being a mass media outlet? How can one person be a mass media outlet just because he has a popular post on LiveJournal? Roskomnadzor, the regulatory body, says, don't worry, it's fine. As long as you don't get a letter from us saying you have to register, and which is registering is, as they say, quite simple. We'll have to check that. It's just a form online and you can go on with your posting. We have to see what's going to happen. But at the end of the day, it's just the beginning. We'll see in a week or two what's going to happen with the blogosphere, and that's going to be quite interesting.
Famil Izmailov in Moscow. Joe Miller, you've been looking at this too. What have you spotted?
Yeah, well, as is almost always the case, the internet is more creative than whichever government is trying to control it. And some of the big blog sites in Russia, like Yandex and LiveJournal, have said that they're going to stop the page counters that count how many people visit a page, so that the Russian authorities don't know when 3,000 people have visited a blogger's page.
An interesting combat there between the bloggers and the government. Now, on to our main theme. Just how healthy can a gadget make you?
Every step you take, every goal you set, every choice you make to be active adds up to a healthier, more awesome you.
Oh, boy, that's an advert for Fitbit, one of the many fitness monitors on the market. I'm not sure quite how awesome they make you. They do sound a bit gimmicky, but devices which can provide remote monitoring of your fitness, your sleep patterns and other physical functions are now being taken very seriously. And not just by major tech firms like Samsung and Apple, but by the medical profession, which is suddenly embracing the idea that personal technology can transform the delivery of healthcare. I spoke to Dr. Amy Abernethy, Professor of Medicine at Duke University, North Carolina.
Physicians, nurses, and others are encouraging patients to use these different monitors as a way of keeping track of what they're doing in their everyday lives, and also as a way of then using that information to provide subsequent guidance. Meanwhile, from the research standpoint, we're starting to think about how we use these data as a way of understanding what people are doing in periods of time between their normal encounters with the healthcare system.
How advanced, though, are these devices? Right now, they seem, to be frank, to be pretty crude, not to give the level of accuracy that you might think a doctor would require.
So there are some devices that are incredibly accurate. They've got gyroscopes and accelerometers, as well as algorithms and ways of partitioning and analyzing the data so that we can do so with enough precision to use these data then in subsequent research studies. Other devices, the ones that you buy over the counter in your usual fitness store or that even your doctor might suggest that you use, are often indeed pretty crude. But the truth is the relative calorie expenditure or activity level for individual person is pretty consistent from day to day, even in the crude devices, so that if you walked 2,000 steps according to your little monitor yesterday, and today it's telling you you've walked twice as far, you know, that's a reasonable approximation of how far you've gone and that you've doubled your activity.
I suppose patients might be cynical about this and think this is an excuse for my doctor not to see me face to face.
That's a great question. So are these various monitors ultimately going to become the substitute for the conversation? In fact, sometimes it will become the substitute for the conversation, but I think more often than not, it becomes information that make doctors and patients together smarter.
So that's Dr. Amy Abernethy. Dr. Hilary Thomas, our special guest with us. You are both a doctor and a consultant on the healthcare industry. Is this a huge trend that we're seeing? Is there really that much enthusiasm from the medical profession to start looking at these gadgets?
Well, I think, in fact, the public are almost leading the medical profession. If you look at the explosion in the use of devices, apps and other technology by individuals, I think the medical profession are almost playing catch-up. And health as such has been slightly slow to follow well-being, really. But it's clear that we are going in that direction. And as we look at better models of care, more prevention, then managing long-term conditions like diabetes, even managing some psychiatric conditions, using technology is the way to go.
But have the devices themselves got to get better? I mean, are we right to trust these devices at the moment? You and I are both wearing fitness monitors. We both expressed some scepticism about what exactly they're measuring.
I think that's right, but in a way, only by using them and only by having a market in them will they get better. You know, if we were to just withdraw, then I don't think it would improve. So I think over time these devices will become more accurate. Interestingly, when I decided which device to buy, I was reading the feedback on them. You know, people were saying, "Well, I'm a fitness freak. This isn't accurate enough for me." On the other hand, if you take regular, you know, moderate exercise, this device has worked very well for me.
Mark Ward, I know you're a bit of a sceptic about this, aren't you? Particularly, yeah. You've got concerns about the security aspects.
That's right. There's been a couple of studies sort of looking at how these things communicate, you know, usually with a smartphone or a laptop or something like that. And actually, a lot of the time, they do a really bad job of protecting that data. I mean, at the moment, it's maybe not much of a problem, but if you're starting to get into situations where insurance companies want that data, then maybe we need to do a better job of protecting that information.
Well, we'll be looking more closely at the whole data issues in this area in a while. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Cathlin-Jones. Time for a quick look at some of the other big tech stories of the week. Mark, more news this week about the supposedly secure Tor system and attempts to hack it.
That's right. Tor is well known as being a way to anonymously browse the internet. And it's sort of on there as well. There's a kind of parallel system of hidden sites that sits alongside the net.
It's the headquarters of the dark web.
A lot of the stuff there isn't indexed. And, you know, there's good and bad uses of that kind of anonymity. And you'd think that anything that compromised that anonymity would be a bad thing. And you'd be right. And for the last 5 months, somebody has been trying to work out who's using these websites, who's browsing things via Tor. And to be honest, it's not clear who it is. There's a feeling that it's some researchers who've been trying to, you know, look at the security of the system. But, you know, the people who run Tor have said, we've looked into it and we hope it's those guys, because if it's not, we've no idea.
To be clear, what they're saying, the people behind Tor, is that people who've been using Tor to visit sites, their identity may not be as secure as they thought.
That's right. This attack works by monitoring who's going in and out of the Tor cloud, if you want, like in the same way that you can monitor people coming in and out of a large building. The more information you have about that, you can spot who they are. But now they've stopped it, they've fixed it, and it should be better than it was.
Moving on, I've been struck this week by what could be a turning point in the key technology of our age, the smartphone market. Samsung, which has dominated Android phones both in market share and in profits, unveiled some pretty disappointing figures. Its share of the global market fell from 32% a year ago to 25% this year, while Chinese firms were making very rapid progress. Francisco Geronimo, who's Mr. Mobile at the research firm IDC, he told me Samsung should fear the rise of much cheaper Chinese handset makers.
The big challenge is coming from the likes of Huawei, Xiaomi, Lenovo, and plenty of new players, new brands that we never heard about before. The message to Samsung is really to be afraid, to address the challenge they will face, because the market is growing, but at lower price points.
So that's Francisco Geronimo. Joe Miller, you've been working on a story about the hacking of Israel's missile defence system, the Iron Dome.
Iron Dome, which is a sophisticated piece of military tech, and it's claimed to have shot down many of the missiles that have been fired out of Gaza in recent weeks. It was developed by two Israeli government-owned defence contractors. And the BBC was given exclusive access earlier this week to a report by a digital security firm in the US, which appeared to show that these firms had been pretty comprehensively hacked in 2011 and 2012, with literally hundreds of sensitive military files stolen. And we're talking gigabytes of data, some of which were protected under US government regulations and included specifications of a piece of tech and documents like relating to the Arrow 3 missiles and drones. But the interesting thing here is that the breach was made using very similar tools to those used by the hackers who broke into American intelligence and security firms a while back. You'll remember that story, which the US then blamed on the Chinese military. The security expert Brian Krebs, who I spoke to earlier this week, told me that given how closely these US firms, the US works with these Israeli firms, it's possible that they were infiltrating them just to get to the Americans, who've now secured their networks a lot better than they had been in the past.
Fascinating. The latest incident in the growing concern over cyber warfare there. Now, back to health, and the real gold rush in this, as in so many other areas, is all about big data. More and more medical data from fitness devices that we've been hearing about, from electronic patient records, is now all going to be available online for researchers to examine in the hope of finding patterns. One of the biggest players in this area is Wolters Kluwer, a business information firm which is very big in healthcare. I spoke to the chief executive, Nancy McKinstry, and asked her about the rush to put our health information on the internet and the privacy concerns that this could spark.
Many governments around the world, whether it's here in the UK or the US, even China, are funding, you know, massive investments in hospitals to get them to adopt electronic medical records.
But at the same time, there's a huge backlash against that, isn't there, of people concerned about the whole privacy issues, about their records being online in the cloud, potentially accessible by anyone.
Yeah, I think that's always the initial concern. But over time, in fact, you know, as customers get used to working in the cloud and as people, for example, ourselves, you know, we have to go through all these security audits, et cetera, I think that that concern is usually able to be addressed. I would say the reason I believe people will overcome this, particularly, professionals, doctors and nurses, is that if you think about the mandate, right? Everybody wants to improve the quality of care, but also lower the cost of care. And in order to do that, you absolutely will have to leverage technology. There's almost no other way to accomplish both of those factors.
Isn't the other debate here the sort of slight conflict between open data, the kind of data that, you know, you get in the likes of kind of Google flu trends or even, say, Wikipedia, and the proprietorial data that you have? You're a for-profit company. You're seeking to profit from data. Isn't that going to come up into conflict at some stage with this big open data movement?
I don't think so right now, because we create data ourselves. We have physicians that work for us. We have a huge body of experts that work on our behalf that create information. So we're not just repackaging information that's created by others. We're actually content creators. Second thing we're doing is building very sophisticated software that is allowing you to actually interpret this data and do something with it. So our goal is we're investing heavily in health. So, of course, we expect a return for that. But we are doing very unique things that are extremely difficult for governments to replicate or even individual physicians to replicate.
That's Nancy McKinstry, Chief Executive of Wolters Kluwer, hoping to mine that big data. Dr. Hilary Thomas, our special guest this week. There is so much excitement about all of this health data. Haven't there been excessive claims about just how valuable it's going to be?
Well, you mentioned Google Flu earlier, and of course the initial view was that Google Flu was going to be far more accurate than anything else, and that's now been disproved.
Remind us what happened there. I mean,
overestimating, essentially. It was overestimating people's internet activity as a sort of surrogate for the fact that they had flu. Some of those people had viral illnesses that weren't flu or had other symptoms or were perhaps making an inquiry on behalf of a friend. So they overestimated quite significantly the actual incidence of the disease at the time.
And the other sort of break on this is national governments getting their populations to trust putting that incredibly confidential data online.
That's right. And building up trust takes a lot longer and a lot more effort than breaking trust. So one adverse story puts the individual off actually sharing their data, even though there may actually be a greater advantage to them in having it shared.
But briefly, what is the promise then? What excites you about this data?
It's what Nancy was implying. It's about generating insight, really. It's how do you use that data to get some insights, and how does that insight turn into some sort of value in terms of how you're going to change the way you manage a condition or the way you encourage people to live their lives?
The big data revolution in medicine, it's already underway. This is Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. Please share your thoughts on today's topics with us and your fellow listeners via our Twitter feed at BBC Tech Tent.
You're breathing in through the nose and out through the mouth. And with the next out breath, just gently closing the eyelids and just feeling the weight of the body as it presses down against the chair or the floor below you.
Well, I'm feeling a bit sleepy now. We're all kind of nodding. No, wake up, everybody. That was the rather soothing voice of Andy Puddicombe that you heard just there. He's a trained Buddhist monk and he's co-founder of Headspace.com, a smartphone app which aims to improve your mental rather than physical well-being by giving you a simple introduction to meditation. He's been promoting the idea of mindfulness, a real buzzword in the tech business community right now, not least to find some respite from digital overload. So it's ironic, I put it to Andy, that he's encouraging us to use a phone app to meditate.
We're aware of the irony. I think the really interesting thing around this is that the phone itself is not the problem. Like, you know, if we look at the phone, it's just this thing. It's this inanimate object. So it's clearly our relationship with it that's the problem. So our kind of feeling about this was, how could we scale this? How could we reach as many people as possible and give them the opportunity to try meditation? Well, clearly that's through the use of the internet and mobile phone. But at the same time, how can we help people change their relationship so they have a more healthy relationship with their phone? So we're actually giving the mind an opportunity to sort of switch off a little bit and just relax a bit more.
And it's turned into a fabulous business for you as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we don't see it as a business. We see it as a social mission. And increasingly, it's not only consumer users. We're finding that large companies and organisations universities, hospitals, sports teams are all kind of requesting the use of it. So we now work across a really broad spectrum of society.
Is mindfulness a fad?
Yes, so this is a question that comes up quite a lot. You know, the first thing to say is mindfulness is a technique which goes back 2,500 years. So I don't think in any way that could be described as faddish. I think the willingness by a Western audience and society to kind of take it on and actually apply it in everyday life, I think that's a new thing. And I do think there's an exceptional amount of enthusiasm around it at the moment. But the science, I think, is so strong now and so compelling. And when we know for a fact that it's going to make us less stressed, it's going to help us focus more and to have more empathy in our life and everything else, I don't think anybody is going to want to see that disappear or miss the opportunity to live a kind of healthier and happier life. So I strongly believe that it will be around for quite some time to come.
Andy Puddicombe of Headspace.com. Dr. Hilary Thomas, we're drawing to a close, but let's draw this together. Which of these areas that we've heard about in terms of technology revolutionising physical and mental health care, which of them excites you most?
I think for me, given that we have long-term conditions that are becoming a real global burden now, not just a burden in developed countries, making an impact on areas like diabetes, like heart disease, that are going to become a consequence of living longer, I think if we can start to see a real impact on the number of people and the seriousness of those conditions, that will be a really big win.
And the route to that will be not via gadgets, but via data, is it?
I think it'll be a mixture. I think it'll be putting people in control of their own health, and I think it will also be by using the data to give feedback to know what the best strategies are.
I've got to bring in Joe Miller here, because I know he was champing at the bit earlier. You're slightly sceptical about this big data idea.
Yeah, well, far be it from me to argue with actual scientists, but we get press release after press release from huge tech firm telling us what they're going to do with big data and health, and in almost none of them is there a line in which I could explain to my mother what they're going to do with it. And I think that leads me to believe that we're quite a way off from this sort of stuff really being useful.
There's certainly a huge tidal wave of hype around this, isn't it, Hilary? Briefly.
I think you're right. If you look at the engagement cycle, people are switching off to the term, and I think we need some examples that switch them back. It's about taking big data to understand what's the small data that we need to look at.
Well, we are running out of time, so thanks to my special guest, Dr. Hilary Thomas, to Joe Miller and Mark Ward. I've also got to report the findings of the three fitness devices I've been wearing. My heart rate is 64 beats per minute, my smartwatch tells me. Today, I've walked either 8,463 steps, according to one fitness band, or 9,463, according to another. Anyway, fighting fit I am for next week's Tech Tent. Join us then.